Welcome to the second podcast in the Foreign Policy Association's virtual roundtable on U.S.-China relations. This series of six 12-minute podcasts aims to develop awareness, understanding, and informed opinion on the key issues underlying the confrontation between the two largest economies of the world. This is Sarwar Kashmiri, and my guest in this podcast is the Singapore-based American journalist Nisid Hajjari. Mr. Hajjari oversees Asia coverage for Bloomberg View, the editorial board of Bloomberg News. He writes on Asian economics, politics, and history, and edits Bloomberg's columns and commentary from the region. He is also the author of Midnight's Furies, The Deadly Legacy of India's Partition, winner of the 2016 Colby Award for Military and International Affairs, and chosen as the best book of the year by the Seattle Times, NPR, and Amazon. He spoke to me from his offices in Singapore. So, Mr. Hajjari, I wanted to start by asking you, on that side of the world, what is the feeling about the American-China relationship?
It's complicated. I mean, in Southeast Asia in particular, there is a countries have a conflicted feeling. They want the U.S. and China to have a presence in this region for different reasons. China, obviously, is the leading trade partner for most of these nations, and the U.S. has been the traditional guarantor of security.
Right.
And countries essentially don't want those roles to change, but at the same time, they don't want to see any sort of conflict or even frictions between the two big powers, because that obviously the fallout affects them. So they prefer things to be as calm on the surface as possible, and they don't want to have to be forced to pick one or the other. You know, they want to have good relations with both. They want the two of them to have good relations with each other. They don't like being asked to take sides. So that disappoints both China and the U.S. In different ways.
But, you know, the United States maintains that it is a Pacific power, and that it needs to be there because navigation of the seas has been an American objective for over 100 years, and that it must continue to maintain that the entire length of the Pacific. How do you see the smaller countries, the Philippines, Malaysia's, Brunei's, Vietnam's, how do they think about that vis-a-vis what you've just told me, which is that they have a large part of their trade with China?
Well, I think they would agree with what you just said. They do see the U.S. as a Pacific power. You know, while China is a major trading partner, the U.S. is also a major trading partner, especially for countries like Vietnam that have signed on to the Trans-Pacific Partnership. If that ever passes, the U.S. will become even more important to them. And they have, since World War II, really relied on both the system the U.S. has set up globally and you know, the U.S. force itself to guarantee the security of trade through the area. So no countries here would really dispute that. I think there are probably a couple of small countries. Cambodia in particular recently has been the beneficiary of a great deal of Chinese aid and has sort of taken China's side in these disputes. But pretty much every other country here accepts the U.S. presence and welcomes it. Now, they won't necessarily phrase that in a way that, say, some hawks in the U.S. might want them to, more diplomatic in the way they couch it, but they certainly don't want the U.S. to pull back in a way that, say, some hardliners in China would like to see the U.S. do.
And I'm thinking now about the recent World Court decision against China brought by the Philippines, in that the court didn't accept China's supremacy on that nine-dash line. The court said that China doesn't own all that area. So what's been the reaction to that?
It's very interesting. There's obviously months and months of buildup to this decision, which came out in early July. And the decision itself was a stinging rebuke to China.
Yes.
It was very clearly and, you know, unanimous decision from all five judges on the tribunal panel that just blew out of the water all of China's claims and said they were inconsistent with international law. Now, it was almost too good of a verdict for the Philippines, which had brought the case in a way, because it caused a great loss of face in China. What's been interesting is there were some people in the U.S. who might have expected or wanted the whole countries in the region to, you know, leap out in support of this verdict and China and demand that China, you know, bring its actions into line with the verdict and so on. That hasn't been the case. ASEAN recently had a meeting earlier this week, and they had trouble putting out a joint statement that condemned China, so they barely mentioned the verdict at all. But what's happening quietly is that all sides are sort of backing down a bit. So China now doesn't really refer to the nine-dash line in its official statements.
Mm-hmm.
And they're talking about returning to talks with Southeast Asian nations, bilateral talks with the Philippines over things like joint fishing rights and things like that. And the U.S. is encouraging this because I think, you know, and rightly so, I think everyone's realized that trying to back China into a corner on this, trying to embarrass them or demonize them, will only provoke a nationalist backlash. I think China realizes that they lost this case, and the best thing that everyone can hope for at this point is that they bring their claims into line over time. And in the meantime, it's better to have everybody talking than to have them shouting at each other or let alone fighting with one another.
But Mr. Hajjari, the United States is not a signatory to the treaty that was adjudicated by the court against China. Does that lessen the impact? The United States doesn't believe in it enough to not ratify it in the Senate?
It doesn't help. You know, on the one hand, while the U.S. hasn't fully ratified the treaty, it does adhere to the rules in practice. So it's been pretty consistent about that and you know, has a decent reputation as far as that goes. But it doesn't help. It certainly would give us a lot more credibility if we're going to be leading this charge in support of international law. It would also, if we ratified the treaty, would allow us to bring cases of our own, such as this, against China or whomever else.
Right.
Which, you know, we currently can't do because we're not a signatory to the treaty. So there really, I mean, it really isn't the U.S. national interest to ratify this treaty. It just gives, not ratifying it, gives China, gives hardliners there, you know, just another excuse to sort of cast doubt on this ruling. You know, they've sort of said, oh, well, a bunch of the judges were picked by a Japanese judge, so obviously the tribunal is biased. The U.S. hasn't ratified the treaty, and in fact, when a judgment went against the U.S., in a case involving Nicaragua in the 80s, the U.S. essentially ignored the judgment, which is also a terrible precedent to set. It gives China an excuse to do the same. So it would be better for the U.S. to sort of bring its actions in line with its principles.
There have been two decisions recently against China. One is the nine-dash line, and the other one is the deployment of anti-missile batteries in South Korea, right? That was done, these American anti-missile batteries, and it was done against strenuous objections from China. What are you picking up from your perch in Singapore? Is this being viewed as two failures for China's President Xi Jinping?
I think outside of China, it has to be seen that way. If you look at Xi's tenure in power, he's accumulated a lot of power domestically, but the only real foreign policy achievement he could have claimed until now was improved relations with South Korea. He had developed very close relations with President Park in South Korea, had looked like he was succeeding in almost driving a wedge between South Korea and Japan, and sort of breaking up the kind of trilateral cooperation between the U.S., Japan, and South Korea. And he has lost all that through his own or his government's own fault by essentially threatening South Korea and telling them that they couldn't take this step of accepting U.S. missile defenses for their own security. And at the same time, not doing enough to rein in North Korea, which was the motivation for this missile defense in the first
right.
place. So I think he's clearly, that initiative, which he could have claimed as a success, is now very clearly a failure. And you know, what else do they have here? China's only real friend in Asia is Pakistan, which is complicated for all sorts of reasons. But they don't have a great record in recent years.
But, you know, the point is always made that when you look at all these countries in Southeast Asia, they know that their future is tied in with China. They really can't push too much or celebrate too much, can they?
Right, and they're not going to gloat or celebrate or again, bandwagon with the U.S. against China. China's not going anywhere. It's geographically at the center of the region, by far the biggest economy. It will always be important to these countries. economically, and they know that. At the same time, it would be hard to argue that there's genuine affection for China in any of these countries. You know, again, in a place like Cambodia, you may have a government, a particular leader who has close ties with the Chinese government and is accepting, you know, hundreds of millions of dollars in aid. But you saw what happens in Sri Lanka, for example, where you also had a leader who was taking cheap loans and aid from China and so on, and then was ousted in an election, in part because of that overdependence on China, and China's influence there has declined dramatically and been replaced by India's. So, something similar happened in Burma and so on. You know, wherever China tries to overplay its hand and sort of treat its smaller neighbors as vassal states rather than as allies or partners, it's backfired. And China still hasn't learned to behave in a different way, I'd say. So I think countries in the region will always want to have good relations with China, but trust and affection is a different story.
Not too long ago, the Shangri-La Dialogue was held in Singapore, the annual gathering of national security senior policymakers from Asian Pacific countries. And as I recall, you were there covering it. What do you think came out of that?
It was interesting. So this dialogue happened in early June, so it's about a month before the tribunal ruling came
out.
So that was obviously the main focus, what was going to happen. And the U.S. sent a huge delegation. You know, sometimes the U.S. is accused of not devoting enough attention to Asia, sort of talking about a pivot to Asia, but not backing it up on the ground. You know, in this case, the Secretary of Defense, Ash Carter, brought something like 65 people just in his delegation on his plane. And then there was, separate from that, a congressional delegation. There was State Department representation. Pacific Command had a big presence here. And all these people, you know, had a pretty unified message for countries in the region, which was that, you know, they needed to support, come together around something that they all agreed upon, which is the sort of rules-based international order based on things like the law of the sea that has been in place since World War II. And that gave countries here something that they could support, that, you know, where they want to come out and say, well, we are doing this because we're supporting the U.S. They're supporting principles that they all shared and that benefited all of them. Ash Carter in his speech talked about a principled network of allies, which was an awkward phrasing, but what he meant was that, you know, these aren't military alliances, these are groupings of countries that agree on keeping these sea lanes open and not allowing any one power to rule over others. And the U.S. as the strongest power here was obviously be the kind of central play a central role. And I think that message was relatively successful. I mean, the Chinese admiral gave the plenary talk on the last day as sort of a rebuttal to all this and claimed that when he was walking around the halls of the Shangri-La Hotel, you know, he wasn't feeling isolated. Everybody wanted to talk to him, which is, of course, true, because as we were just talking about, you know, these countries don't want to alienate China, but the sentiment there was very much against China, and I think they must have felt that.
And so I must ask you now, why you think that China does not interfere with North Korea's nuclear ambitions?
Well, you know, so China is doing a lot more than it has in the past. You know, it allowed very strong sanctions to pass in the UN, much stronger than we've ever had before. But at the same time, China's ultimate fear here is a unified Korea dominated by Seoul and backed up by U.S. troops. They don't want to see U.S. troops on China's border, essentially. You know, you have to remember, this is the one place where the U.S. and China have fought a war. So that's their goal. They're not, you know, too concerned about whether North Korea's actions make the U.S. insecure. In fact, that's probably, you know, in their eyes, a good thing. It's, you know, keeps the U.S. a little bit worried. They don't want to see things get out of control, but they're also not going to cut off the North and provoke a collapse there, because that's the one thing they really don't want to see.
You've been listening to a conversation with Nisid Hajjari, recorded for the Foreign Policy Association's podcast series on U.S.-China relations. The music on all these podcasts was performed by the Norwich University Regimental Band, the oldest regimental band in the country. We invite you to tune in to the next conversation in the series. Until then, this is your host, Sarwar Kashmiri. Thank you for listening.